So I guess I'll start. So, okay, I'm going to talk about Julia. A bold title here, but I have some faith. Let me say, so I've written a talk outline over here. And part of that is because I'm going to be using a few different technologies. I actually only have three slides on PDF, and you've seen two of them now. Then I'm going to switch to the Julia REPL, which is the read eval print loop. That's basically typing into Julia. I'll do a little bit of demo at the Julia REPL. But then I will switch over to a Julia Notebook, which is a web browser-based system that combines sort of math and graphics and live code. Okay, it's a nice pedagogical system. And then I'll go through these things. So basically, I'm going to do some demos, which are like, I will belabor that. Let me belabor this, though. So this is a new scientific programming language. It's got the modern feel of Python. It's general purpose language. It's aimed at numerics like MATLAB. It's got the self-referential metaprogramming power of Lisp, which is really something. And then amazingly, it runs as fast as C or Fortran. So it's like got everything in it. Okay. Actually, that's one of the things. It uses square brackets. So that's one of the things. If you come from MATLAB, the first thing you have to remember is square brackets instead of parentheses. Parentheses are for functions and lists. Square brackets are indexing. Okay. And so here's a big thing about Julia. Because it does all these things really well, you can do interactive tinkering at the command line for data exploration or prototyping like you would in MATLAB or Python. But then in the same language, you can do HPC. So you don't have to go back and forth between Fortran and Python for your work.
So yes. Is it a script language, or is it something you have to compile?
It's good question. So if here is scripting interpreted language, here are compiled languages. Julia's in the middle. It's just-in-time compiled. So you interact with it like it's interpreted language, only it's always like sucking things over and compiling them into machine language. And I'll demonstrate that.
MATLAB,
if you want your code to run as fast as C, you have to do it in a MEX file. So what Julia does is sort of automatically do that.
The problem with MATLAB is not speed, it's memory. Do you manage memory?
It does the memory management. Yeah, it's more like MATLAB when it comes to memory management than it is C.
That's different. I mean, the problem with MATLAB is it doesn't fit in any. Any
reasonable
program doesn't fit in any
reasonable
computer.
Okay.
Let's continue on.
I didn't know this was
going to
be continued.
Okay. So, and I think you'll see some answers to that as I go. Okay. So, just a little bit of background about the language. The language is a new language. It's about 4 years old. Since its first public release. It's currently at version 0.5 with plans to get to 1.0, to go straight from 0.5 to 1.0 sometime in 2017. I hope they make it then. So it's still a little bit in flux. It's an open source free language. It's under an MIT license, which is more liberal than the GNU license. All the source code is hosted on GitHub. You can go out there and see it anytime you like and download it, contribute to it. The core development team started at MIT in computer science and applied math. Alan Edelman is one of the people really behind this language from applied math there. Then there's a small company formed by the core founders to commercialize, to generate some revenue for support. Although it's always under this MIT license, and it's going to stay there, according to them. It does have support from various foundations, including Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation, from the Intel people, NSF. NumFocus is this a group of, they fund a bunch of different things, Python stuff. Then there are Wall Street companies, Intel, Microsoft also supporting money. And there are a lot of developers for Julia who are embedded in companies, like Linux kernel developers are. And contributing. So to the core language, there are currently about 600 people who have contributed to the core language, and we've got about 1,000 packages. So this is a fairly sizable group. This language isn't going to wither and die anytime soon. Okay, so that's it for my PDFs. Kill that off. Okay, here we go. So, let me do a little MATLAB-like demo with Julia. Okay. So here, can you read? Is that big enough there? Okay. So here's Julia. I got a prompt. I'm going to say A equals rand N 5x5. Okay. I got a random matrix. Let's say X equals random 5, rand N.
So I'll fix your typos? That's the main thing I need to
know. So this is tab completion.
Okay. Now, if you're watching so far, this probably seems very familiar to you. You know, okay. What does it remind you of? MATLAB. Okay. Now watch this. This is the first sort of non-MATLAB-y thing. I type that. Now I hit tab, and now I have an x hat variable. And I'm going to call that A/B. Okay, I just did a solve, and then I can do a norm of x minus x.
So is that the same as in MATLAB if you do A/B?
Yeah. So there we go. And then we can do things like A, comma 1. Okay, so this is just demonstrating to you, if you know MATLAB, it's an easy jump into Julia.
Is that running your computer?
That's running on my laptop right now, yeah. Okay, and then as I go along, I'm going to be introducing little things, little refinements like this, like beta here. I type beta, I hit tab, and it turns it into beta. So here's one modernism of Julia. The source code text is Unicode. You can have, Greek, Hebrew, whatever. Variables, and you can have infix operators, you can have a circle cross infix operator, you can define if you like. Okay, so that's just that. Now I'm out of here, I've done my Julia REPL. Now I'm going to switch, instead of typing everything out by memory, I'm going to switch to a notebook in which my talk is all prepared. So I'm going to do that by bringing into Julia, I'm going to say, right now I want it to load in this iJulia package, which is interactive Julia notebooks, and I'm going to start up a notebook in the current directory, like this. Okay, what that's going to do is start up Chrome. Okay, so what happened just there, it drew up a Chrome browser, and it started a socket between this browser and my Julia compute engine. And I'm going to now click on this file. And here is my Julia notebook. And the notebook is comprised of, now that's the wrong use of comprised. The notebook is made from, is built up of different blocks. This block is a text block. Then here I have a code block, and this is sort of live code. I'm going to execute it, and it'll produce the results.
John?
Yes.
So how did you generate this?
How did I generate that? I started up a Julia notebook, and I said, open up a cell, and I want this cell to be of type text. This is a markup language, simple markup, so like one hash is a title. Four hashes is a subtitle, a fourth level subtitle. I just wanted it right. You can see right here, here's a little bit of LaTeX between dollars. I'll have some fancier math later on. So I can do that. I can, now I can say.
So that's just a text file that is being
Yeah, this is a
Chrome.
Yeah, this, well, it's a, it's let's see, it's a JSON file, which is, I forget what that's an acronym for, but it's basically like XML.
Okay.
And it has a text chunk here. Yes.
So John, it might be worth pointing out for those who are not familiar that this is the same as a Python notebook.
Yes, this is the same as a Python notebook. Jupyter stands for Julia Python
Terminal
or Erlang or R or something like that. Those things. Yeah, so this technology was originally developed in Python, and then the Python guys figured out, wait a second, we can decouple the Python engine, compute engine, from the interface. And so they generalize the interface, and then now Julia works with it. Okay, so I can sit here. I double-clicked on that box to bring up the raw formatting text, and then if I hit Control, and I typed foobar there, right here, and now if I hold Shift-Enter, it converts it back to text. And, you know, let me just do int, you know, 0 to 1 x. DX.
But you don't need to be online. I mean, this is just
This is just running. This is all running in my on my laptop. The compute engine, the web server, the all of this. So, you know, I just added this little bit of LaTeX. Okay. So now let's go here, and I'll show you. This is what I did at the REPL. I have, I created a random matrix. I have my X hat. And I'm going to come here, I'm going to hit Shift-Click on this and have it evaluate. Okay, so there's one new thing here, and that's this at show. Okay, this is metaprogramming in Julia. This is kind of the simplest. In Julia, you do metaprogramming with what are called macros. Unlike a C macro is a textual substitution, a Julia macro is a code substitution. So the macros understand the syntax of the language. They take expressions in the language, modify the expressions, and then evaluate them. So this at show is taking this expression, norm ax hat minus b, and basically at show is the simplest macro. What it does, it says, print the expression, put an equal sign, and then evaluate the expression. So print the expression, equal sign, evaluate the expression. Okay. So that's a code transformation. Okay. Now, okay, here's a SVD.
They all begin with at.
Yeah, all the macros begin with at.
So what's the macro for the evaluate? So the at show seems like print the expression.
No, well, at show is print the expression, print an equal sign, then evaluate the expression.
It's all of it.
Yeah,
okay.
All together.
Sorry.
That's okay. So, okay, SVD, this is not so interesting. This is just like MATLAB. I guess we've done this before. Okay, now, let me say a little bit, and maybe this is addressing Javier slightly, and it might maybe not a complete answer, but one thing, here's the next improvement of Julia over MATLAB is being much, much smarter about types. Okay, and you'll see this first line here is showing you the type of when I you know hit return on a variable, it shows the value of the variable prefaced by its type. Here, showing you is a 4x4 array of 64-bit floats. That's the 16 digits, double precision. Same thing as in C. And it's a two-dimensional array, that is, you know, a matrix. And in particular, okay, so this variable is a matrix. This is a matrix type. It's a matrix of floats. Unlike in MATLAB, where everything is a complex matrix, you know, even a scalar. So now down here, the reason I did this here, okay, here's the result of that norm. It's a number. It looks like what MATLAB would print. But if you look at the type, it's a float 64. It's a single number. It's not a complex matrix, a one-by-one complex matrix like MATLAB would do. Okay, so Julia has a much more nuanced idea of types than a language like MATLAB, and that's really important to the efficiency in memory and speed. And I'll show more of why that's true as we go along. Rodolfo, yeah.
You will show more of why that's true.
So. I will show more of why that, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, yes, I will. That was what your question.
I was going to ask, wait, but does it just know that an output from a norm is a float?
Yeah, okay, that's right. So you'll notice I didn't declare any types here. But so Julia is smart about types. It does what's called type inference. And I, you know, I input these numbers. The default would be float 64. I'll show you some more examples of this. So Julia, behind the scenes, as if it can figure out what type a variable is, it's, you know, well, it always can once it's computed. Let me postpone this. I'll get into, I have a better place to talk about this later. Okay, so here's some further fanciness over MATLAB. Eigenvalues of a symmetric matrix. Okay, so this is, I'm going to make a symmetric matrix A by first taking a random unsymmetric matrix, and then I'm going to use a pipe. This is like a Unix pipe, only you have to do this, since, you know, that just means OR in a typical language. So this is Unix, and I'm going to pipe this matrix through a map which takes arbitrary object and adds it with its transpose, or Hermitian conjugate, making it symmetric.
And now my question is, when you do that, if you're creating a new matrix which is T prime.
That's a good, okay, so good point, good point, yes, yes. So I will get into this further. Actually, I will really get into that kind of question right here on the Kermode-Sivashinsky demonstration. So maybe a broad answer to this is that you can do things in Julia which, yes, will take this will construct the conjugate transpose and add them together and then assign it into there. As is. Now, I have actually seen the Intel team demonstrate macros that take expressions like this and transform them into loops which perform the same operation without the temporaries. Okay. Okay, so that's an example of an anonymous function, a pipe. Okay, another show. And then notice here, this is one of many minor things, but notice I've used this I identity matrix without declaring it. In MATLAB, you would have to say that is I of 4x4. But in Julia, the identity is a generic identity. And this in particular one operates on ints. So there are different forms of it for different numeric types. But you could use that in a differential expression if you wanted to. Okay. So now let's load in a couple packages. So there's a bit of problem with this pyplot, needs to update some GTK syntax, but those are just warnings. I've loaded in an ODE integrator in the plotting thing again, and I'll just show you, here's how to integrate the Lorentz equations. I declare a function, this is just like MATLAB, you put the T first and the X there, declare sigma beta rho, and then the return value is, okay, in the Julia function, the last expression is the return value. I could type return there, but it's not necessary. So basically, I take my vector x, I compute those components of the Lorentz equation, that gives me a function, and then I can run that function through Julia's ODE 4.5 to get t and x, and then do some plotting.
So John?
Yeah?
In Python, I'd worry that 8 over 3 would be 2.
That's right. And Julia, okay, good point. So Julia is not that. Julia will, a division between two integers will give you a float. If you want the fraction, I'll show you this a little bit later. Julia has a rational number system. You put two divides there, and it would give you a rational. And then if you wanted to do integer division, you would use div 8,3. Okay, so there we go. Okay, so, oops. Why?
That's what should happen.
Something.
It's kind of an artifact. Nobody enters.
Okay. Wow. That's a first for me. There we go. Okay. So there's our plot of Lorenz. Nice 3D plot. So now I am through 2A and 2B, which are MATLAB-like stuff with little nuances. Now I'll go to my next notebook, which is demonstrating, which we're sort of leave MATLAB behind.
So is there any disadvantage compared to MATLAB, or is there anything you can say about
that? Yeah, so, okay, good question. So the plotting is not as good as MATLAB's plotting right now. So Julia, right now, the plotting, there are a number of different plotting packages, and the one I'm using is PyPlot, which is Matplotlib, and there's just a Julia interface to Matplotlib. So, you know, you get what Matplotlib has, but it's not as good as 3D, the 3D plotting in MATLAB. You know, MATLAB has Simulink in it, Julia doesn't have Simulink. What else? Oh yeah, and MATLAB has, you know, MATLAB has really nicely designed like nonlinear optimization stuff, and there are libraries for that in Julia. And in fact, Julia, one of the things that Julia was designed for is to make calls to standard libraries very easy. So, for example, all the 64-bit float linear algebra in Julia, it could be done with a generic Julia code, but they call LAPACK instead, because LAPACK's tuned, you know, LAPACK, you know, a lot of work gone into LAPACK. So it's easy to make interfaces to well-developed libraries, open source libraries, but so they have like the nonlinear optimization, they have interface to that, but it's maybe people tell me it's not as professionally, it's not as great as the MATLAB nonlinear optimization.
Tom, are you going to say something about how easy it is to combine with MPI and OpenMP?
I am a little bit, but I'm kind of, I almost put this like in my introduction. I'm not going to talk about parallelism in any depth. I do have a link to it, and I can talk about it later with you later. But it does do this. Yes, it does have both MPI at the sort of low-level call to the C, and it also has its higher-level idea of parallelism through distributed arrays and you know, objects talking to each other through networks. Yeah.
Can Julia parse other languages?
Parse other languages. It does have a parser in it.
So if you give it a bit of Python or some C, can it?
That's a good question. I don't. I'm probably not the person to ask about that. So, yeah, that's a really good question. It's got a parser and it's parsing itself. And it's using LLVM, which is compiler technology for much of its operations. And LLVM, I don't know if LLVM handles Python or not. Okay, so I don't know the answer to that question. Mike, what were you saying?
Somebody's probably writing the parser for Python right now.
Yeah. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about, we're going to leave MATLAB behind. We're going to talk about the type system it built. We're going to talk about Julia's numeric types, user-defined types, a little bit more on macros. So right now I'm going to just demonstrate a bit more about how Julia has this really nice, rich numerical type system. I won't talk much about the general purpose types, but let's explore the numeric type system. So I'm going to restart and clear output. Okay, so this has, I worked through my notebook last night, I'm just going to clear the output and we'll generate it afresh. So here, pi. What is pi? In C, pi is a 16-digit floating point number, right? In Julia, pi is, notice these little dots here. Well, what is that type of pi? Pi is an irrational, okay? Okay. So Julia has this numeric type system which starts up number at the top and then real and complex fork under that, and then under real are rationals, or under real, yeah, I don't know, okay, I won't get all the forks in that right, but integers, integers, rationals, and the fixed size floating point numbers. Okay, And you can take, so the irrational pi, you can truncate it at, you know, you can get a 64-bit version of this irrational, and that's what you would have in C. Or if you're not satisfied with that, you can use the arbitrary precision floating point numbers, which are part of the type system. And this is default, I think it's the default is set to 256 bits, and you can change that. This is using the GNU multi-precision library underneath. So there is pi to 256 bits, I think it's like 80 digits or something like that. And there, if we do this Euler formula and evaluate it, you see we get 1 with all these zeros, and then, yeah, 77. So the imaginary part works out to 0 to 77 digits. Okay.
So if you do a, if you just put the pi symbol in there, your e to the
Good. That's a good question. I don't know what will happen.
It seems like you could rapidly run away with precision here and end up using much more time and memory than you wanted to.
Yes. So, you know, what you determine what type. You know, if you start with some variable, you tell, you know, the default is a 64-bit. If you want to go to higher precision, you have to do something like this. I convert my rational to a type big float.
So if I just use their symbol pi.
And let's see what happens. Okay. So now I'll open up another window here. Let's say x pi times 1 im. Okay. So Julia, rather than using I or j, uses im. Okay, what's going to happen? Okay, it converts it to, by default, it does it to 16.
Okay, good. That's 64 bit. Sensible default.
Okay. Whoops, and now I have to rerun this again. I have to rerun this because I have type of answer. So like MATLAB, ANS is the last result. So I just reran this line right here. So now when I do type of answer, it's going to give me the type of this quantity. Okay, so that was a complex number built of big floats. Okay. Oh, yeah. Now, here, I'll demonstrate the rationals. Here, I'm taking a pi, converting it to a 32-bit float, single precision, and then forming a rational approximation to pi by this type conversion.
What is it in Kansas? It seems like
Kansas? I don't get it.
Oh, they had a law in which
that, okay.
It seems like lots of places for Kansas.
Okay, so I took these two numbers as integers, and I did the divide, which the result dividing integers gives you a float. I converted that back. So this would do a 64-bit float, convert it back to a 16-bit, and then compare the 16-bit division to the 16-bit, or not 6-bit, sorry, 32-bits. Okay, so these two numbers are the same. That's the thing. My rational approximation is good to single precision. Okay, here's how we do a complex number. Okay, and the type of that answer, it's a complex over 64-bit floats. And here is a rational number. I think I mentioned before to make rational numbers and use this double divide on integer types. And so that is 5/3 plus, I meant to say 7/9 just to make that interesting. 9/9 there, type of answer. That's a complex rational of 64-bit ints. Okay, so you can see this is a very rich numerical type system.
Can you define your own types?
Oh, yes, I'll show you that. That's coming up. Okay, so here's a bit about the number system. So this is live, you know, dynamic type introspection. Okay, so I've got, this is a type, I'm looking at its subtypes, it tells me if complex numbers are reals, what are the subtypes of real, well, those are abstract floats, integers, irrationals, and rationals, some types of abstract floats, etc. And then I can do operations on the types. Okay, so here, this is a subset symbol. So are int32s numbers? Yes, they are. Are int64s a subset of the reals? Yep. Are int64s a subset of floats? 64s, nope. And this is not a type operation, this is a set operation, but I just stuck it in there anyway. Is 17 an element of the set 0 to 21 by steps of 3? No, it is not.
So there's a Boolean type somewhere as well.
Yeah, there's a Boolean type in there too. I guess it's not under, I don't think it's under number.
Okay. No.
Let's do that. Type of ANS. Yeah. Okay. So next, we've got all those nice numbers. I'm going to show you now some linear algebra over rationals. Okay, so this is, I'm going to form a random matrix of integers, like MATLAB. This is rand integers. Is that right? I think so. I don't know whether this is integers or it's probably floats. I don't know, a 5x5 random of floats. I'm going to convert those to rationals. I think this must be integers inside. I'm going to convert those to rationals over big ints and a matrix of them, and then I'm going to divide that matrix by 10. Okay, so there's a matrix of rational numbers. And now we can do our linear algebra. Let's see. I created a random x, did a multiplication, a times x, to get those nice fractions, and then I can do a back solve. Okay. Now I can do a back solve here because Julia, in addition to having LAPACK underneath, has generic arbitrary type LU decomposition algorithm. So as long as my rationals can do plus, minus, times, divide, I can do an LU decomposition over them, and thus this back solve. Okay, and okay. Okay, yeah, isn't that nice? So it got the answer right. Okay, so Julia has all these algorithms, both, you know, expressed in generic operations and then links to LAPACK for floats, the appropriate floats. Now here's the question about user defined types. So I swiped this from Andreas Nowak, and I was talking last night, Johannes, it wasn't Bernd Nowak, it was Andreas. I just remembered it wrong. So this is a guy at MIT, he's the sort of core linear algebra person in Julia. And we're going to define finite Skamer field, a Galois field, essentially integers modulo p. Okay, so this is definition of a new type. I'm going to say here GF is the type name. It's going to have a number P, which is a prime, and then a type, which is a subtype of integer, which is how we're going to store all these numbers. And this thing is going to, we're going to stick it in the type hierarchy under number. Okay, it has one data member. Okay, so this is kind of like a C++ class definition here. It has one data member, and that data member will be whatever integer type we gave it. And then so far we're going to define one function. This is like a C++ constructor where I take an integer and I create an object of GF just by modding that integer with the prime number. Okay, so that's how we that's the basic definition of this new type. And now let's see. Okay, so this I don't understand this, so I won't ask you to understand it either. I understand it a little bit. These are conversion rules. These are some basic things that numbers have to do, and we have to define them for a new number type. We have to define the one, we have to define the zero, we have to define how to do a show, you know, how to print them, and how to convert them from some other integer types. So basically, you can see here what's an example that we can understand. I don't know. Let's skip that. The next one, I'll show you. Here's some stuff. Now, this one we can understand. This is maybe the coolest chunk of code I will show you today. So this is now, we've defined one and zero and so on. We also have to define arithmetic operations on this type. So what we're going to do is we're going to import from the base library these operators because we're going to add to them. Okay, and now we're going to add to them by, we're going to loop over the operators, okay? We are going to build an expression which says, okay, loop over the operators, and we're going to build this expression, substitute in one by one the plus operator here. That will say, okay, so what we're doing here, we're building a Julia expression, which is going to define each one of these operators, and then after we've built the expression, we're going to evaluate it. And that's going to tell, so we have to use Julia code to build the Julia expression, which defines how an operator works, and then evaluate it. And when we evaluate that expression, it will stick it in the system so it knows how to do pluses on this type. So this is like, in C++, this would be doing your operator overloading. But the cool C++, there's so much boilerplate. You have to do all this stuff. What's great about this is we're using Julia to automatically generate the and then execute the boilerplate code. Okay, so you can see what's happening. It says, if you want to add two objects of type GF, what you do is take the data, the number underneath, perform that operation on it, that'll give you another integer, and then convert that integer back to a GF. And that conversion, as we defined it before, does the modulus operation. Okay.
So, that piece of code means that there is no divide or divide.
Aha, very good, very good. So I left off the divide. Divide is a little trickier because you have to, if you divide by zero, you have to throw an exception. So later on, I'll do divide. Okay, so now I've defined how to do those arithmetic operations. I'll construct two variables in this field and then perform some operations on them. And if you, you know, if you think about what's happening, you know, this is mod 5, so, you know, 9 mod 5 is 4, 8 mod 5 is 3. And this is the correct modular arithmetic. Okay, so here's how to do divide. You have to be careful. If you divide by zero, you have to throw an exception. Otherwise, do it that way. Okay. Okay, so now divide works. And now, note here, we defined divide, but not backslash. Backslash is just, you know, reverse division. But up in the number class, there's a generic definition of backslash, which means, you know, just switch and divide. And since we define divide, the backslash works because it goes up to number. Number knows how to do it, and then it does it using the specific divide we want. Okay. Now, let's make a matrix of elements in this Galois field. Okay, so this is kind of funny syntax. I'm looping over I and j, and for each I and j, do a random number between 0 and 4 and assign it to a Galois field, and then you get a 4x4 matrix of whose elements are elements of this Galois field. And now let's do the same thing to make a vector b, and now we'll do a backslash. And lo and behold, the backslash works. Backslash works even though I didn't write a backslash algorithm or an LUD composition, because the generic LUD composition works because I define plus minus times divide. Okay. Pardon me? Seems miraculous?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the guys who designed this language, I just got so that much admiration for them. They really like brought a whole lot of knowledge of history of programming languages and problems, and did a great job of you know, smoothing out all sorts of issues. Okay, so there we go. I got zeros, I got the right answer. My answer is of the same type. Now let's look at this. This is a little, okay, I'm gonna use this macro which. The macro which takes this expression and does a little parsing and figures out what does plus mean in this context. Well, x and y are variables of the type gf, but I don't know, this is probably a little bit too subtle to get into, but we actually have to add them with this generic number because these are global variables and their type might change later on. So Julia is a little bit more uncertain about the types of global variables, even though right now they are members of this Galois field. The type inference can't go directly there now. This has consequences later on, but I don't think I want to get into it so much. Let's do a direct, so if we actually put literal elements of this Galois field, then it tells us, okay, which addition are we doing? We're doing the addition that you defined in your input 30 on line 5. Okay? And then over here, that is a hyperlink to GitHub, and there's the line of code on GitHub where that addition is defined. So anytime you want to know anything, so this is part of what makes it a modern language, you know, it's totally internet aware. Okay.
So then Julia is written in Julia?
Yeah, so okay. Julia has the parser. Okay, Julia has Scheme, Femto Lisp, a little core Lisp engine. It has some C in it, but the big difference is that the standard libraries are written in Julia, and that's because Julia code runs as fast as C. So Python, if you write a Python library, you write C code and put a Python wrapper over it. So that because the C runs fast and the Python is slow. But in Julia, since the Julia is as fast as C, you can write your standard library in Julia. So Julia's kind, you know, besides, you know, deep down there's some C and Lisp. I'll demonstrate this a bit when we get to roughly as fast as C. Okay, and here, which 4 plus 8, that's the integer. Okay, now here we're going to do some comparisons of the, we have this user-defined type, and we have built-in, types that are, you know, keyed to the 16-bit types that we have specialized floating-point hardware for. So let's do some comparisons of, timing comparisons of the matrix multiplication of an integer matrix and this Galois matrix, okay? And you see the Galois is about 10 times slower, which is not great. Okay, and here's LU factorization. Again, it's about 10 times slower. And according to Andreas Nowak, the guy who did this code, really the increased cost over this matrix multiplication is simply due to the fact that you're doing modulus operations at every step. So there's a division in there. Every time you do an addition, there's a division. Okay, so far that is, oh yes, and this is really something. This is really something. Here's more from Andreas Nowak that is beyond my, I certainly couldn't do this myself, but I want to show it to you. If I can find the right place in this notebook. Okay, there's the Galois stuff. And what I'm going to show you is some symbolic math. Here we go. Okay. Whoops. Oh, darn it, I had it. It was right about here. Yeah, come on. Did I miss it? Where is that symbolic? Quaternions? It's above quaternion. No. Quaternions. Here we go. Okay. So now, we're using a package which is an interface to Python symbolic library. And we're going to create, first here, a matrix of variables zeta with subscripts, three of them. And then we're going to create a diagonal matrix of deltas, three of them. And then we're going to make a matrix, a symbolic matrix, whose first element is alpha. So this is like MATLAB stacking. I have one number, then I have a Z transpose, so that's these things, and then I have this Z vector and that diagonal matrix. Let's jam them all together and form a symbolic matrix here.
So when we use it like this, let's say we had another class of sim somewhere earlier, does it overwrite it? Like in math, in Python, you usually, say import SymPy with this name and then call.
Okay. Yeah. Using SymPy as I don't have import right here. Import the whole thing. And actually I don't know much about that, but I'm sure, so much of the package system is modeled after Python that it's probably the same thing.
But bar in there is complex conjugate?
Yeah, bar is complex conjugate.
When did that happen?
During this Hermitian conjugate.
Like prime is not.
Yeah, prime is conjugate transpose, yeah. So then, using this symbolic library, we can do things like compute the determinant of this matrix, compute the inverse of that matrix. Okay, so that's pretty great. So we have a.
You set A44 to zero.
A44 to zero. Oh, that's a good question. I'm not sure why that was done. I just copied this stuff from Andreas's notebook. Right. I don't understand why.
Maybe the matrix was singular and you have to change the value.
Yeah, maybe that's it. Maybe it simplifies even more easily.
Index from zero or from one?
So index was from one. Indices are from one.
You kill three terms in the determinant, so then the matrix, probably the inverse becomes palatable. Your determinant has four terms. Three of them have delta 3. So if you set A44 to 0, you set delta 3 to 0. So your determinant becomes one term. And then you probably can do the inverse operation. Not similar, but it's not like this.
Right.
It might be a question of yes or this size.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to go back to there. Okay, we're done with that notebook. Let's close that down. Next is, I'm going to show you roughly as fast as C. And let's flush the, okay, good. Okay, so now the point is to demonstrate how does Julia do stuff as fast as compiled C. So we're just going to, define a simple function, f of x, is x cubed minus 2. Okay. And I'm going to run it twice, and I'm going to use the time macro, which what the time macro does is it takes a bit of code, it puts something like a MATLAB tick-tock around it, and then it does a print of the tick-tock value, executes the code, and then prints the elapsed time. So that's why it's a macro again. It's taking this, adding some more code to it that does the timing, and then evaluating the results. Okay, wow, check it out. So the first time we ran this function, it took a hundredth of a second. And the second time we ran it, it took 4 milliseconds. Okay, why is that? Okay, the second evaluation, okay, this time is much more than 4,000 times faster than the first. Why is that? It's because of just-in-time compilation. So quickly, what Julia does is, I write a function like this. I write it without specifying the type. But as soon as I run it on a 64-bit float, Julia says, aha, I need this function for 64-bit floats. Let me instantiate basically a bunch of C code for 64 for this thing, where that's a double precision number. And I'll compile it and squirrel that away for further use. So that happens here. We have a few macros. Now these macros are showing you the code transformations to get down to machine language. The first one is code lowered. That takes some expression and returns a sort of Julia level. This is Julia's, a print of Julia's abstract syntax tree. Okay, and it's basically the same. Now the next level is to take, is to go to what's called an intermediate compiler language, and the compiler is LLVM. LLVM used to stand, was an acronym for something, but they sort of left that behind. I don't even know what it means. It's a compiler. Okay, and it has an intermediate language where you can take a bunch of different high-level language like Fortran, C, Julia, Python, transform them into this intermediate language, and then there's another set that takes the intermediate language and generates machine code for different architectures. So that's what the intermediate language is. It's sort of a generic, you can think of it as generic machine code. So this is saying, okay, I'm going to take this X, it's a double, and it's in register 0. I'm going to multiply it together with the floating point multiplication, put it in register 1. Then I'm going to multiply 0 times that thing, when in register 1, put that in 2. That's now X cubed. And then let's add negative 2 to X cubed. And put it in 3, and then return that. Okay, so that's kind of that's generic machine code, and now code native shows us. Let's actually go all the way down to the machine language for the chip on my laptop, which is Intel 64, and these are Intel 64 arguments, or machine instructions.
Is this native code optimized for the properties of your CPU, like if it has some multiplier units or this sort of thing, or is not optimized?
Yeah, so you know, it's I'm no expert on LLVM, but you know, it's a compiler with optimization. So presumably, I don't know what kind of flags are automatically set in. You're talking about optimization levels, how much transformation
you can compile your code. You have different optimizations level, exactly.
I suppose so. I don't know how to answer that.
So what I would think is probably you're handing over to LLVM GCC instructions. So your optimization will be similar to what you get from the GNUC compiler, but not from Intel compiler, which can be.
Yeah, not like probably not like an Intel compiler, you know, that's really good. So now I'll just show you, I'm going to show you the machine code for F running on 64-bit float and F running on an integer, and it generates, basically, it generates the machine code for the double precision and for the 64-bit int. So that's why Julia can, you know, you take that F, it runs as fast because it figures out what the type is, and that type, it has a machine representation and specific chip instructions for doing those operations. It generates those and compiles them, squirrels them away for later use. Okay, so that's partially, this is a particularly simple function, but you can imagine a bigger function which has lots of temporary variables, and as long as Julia can figure out the types of all the temporary variables based on the input argument, it can do this just-in-time compilation. If it can't figure out the types, it has to do it in a sort of higher level fashion like Python, where at runtime you're figuring out what the type is and then calling the library. That runs slower.
A float or something.
Uh-huh.
It has the value minus 1. Mm-hmm. And then you say square root minus 1. What does it do?
Yeah, that one, so Julia throws an error there because I'm pretty sure that's true. I've seen this before. Squirt minus 1. Yeah, domain error. Try squirt complex. Yeah. Okay. So now, okay, we've seen what just-in-time compilation is. Now I'm going to do a timing comparison of, I'm going to take the logistic map and iterate it a million times in Julia and in C and do timing comparisons. So And I'm doing something a little bit sort of unnecessarily fancy in the Julia, just to give you another idea of how this the high-level dynamism can let you do things in code that, oh my gosh, I wish I could do this in C++. What I'm doing, okay, so I define f of x, here's a logistic map. Now I'm defining a function called iterator, which takes an f and an n. And what it does is it constructs another function that iterates f n times and returns the value, the last value. Okay, constructs that function, and then returns that function as its output. So I'm writing, since, you know, basically I'm writing code here that generates more code. Okay, I'm not using macros, but I'm just doing this symbolically. So right here now, I take my f and the number million, and I run f through this iterator function. It constructs another function that iterates the logistic map a million times. So there are specific places in channel flow where I wish I could just construct right there a little function of one variable and optimize it, get the right answer, and then throw the function away. But in C++, I have to go outside. I have to actually go into a library. I have to, like, instantiate something at compile time in order to do that. Okay, so there we go. So let's run that, okay? And we'll run it twice, and okay. So I ran it twice. First time it took 1/100th of a second, third time 3 milliseconds. Okay, and also, yes, the first time it allocated a lot more memory because it was using the compiler, you know, operating the compiler. The second time, you know, only 176 bytes, so that's, you know, a few variables. That's just great. Okay, and then what's the value of x? There it is. Okay, so now that was the Julia version. Now here I'm going to show you the C++ version, and here's a little trick of Julia. If you put a semicolon as your first character, it drops you down to the shell. So I'm going to do a bunch of Linux shell operations here to compile this code. I'm in this particular directory. I have this file fmillion of C++ code that I wrote. Here's the C++ code that does, you know, defines a logistic map and then iterates it a million times and does some timing around it and returns the time and the value. Let's compile that function and then execute it. Okay, and then let's go back and do the Julia again. Okay, so here we go. They got the same answer. They got the same answer because they're doing the same. Actually, the compiler didn't rearrange the multiplications or anything. They did the very same sequence of computations and got exactly the same answer for a millionth iterator of the logistic map. And the Julia, the overhead for Julia is about a factor of, it's about 50%. Roughly more expensive than the compiled C.
So what happens if you evaluate x equals 0?
It better be.
What do you mean, sir?
Yes, let's do f super n of 0.0. Better be 0. Oops.
Million times.
Okay. So here is a graphic of timing comparisons of Julia versus other languages for over here. Let me get this up there. So here's a set of numerical operations, you know, done repeatedly in big loops. And basically the same thing translated bit by bit to various languages. Here's a random matrix multiplication. Here's some statistics on random matrices. Here's computing pi by some big sum Malebranche set. This is printing floating point numbers, quicksort, Fibonacci numbers, and parsing an integer. And then down here we have Julia, Fortran, Go, all these languages. And the timing is all normalized so that C, the time of C is 1. Okay, so you see Julia, the time for Julia, sometimes you get a little bit faster than C. Most of the time you're maybe a factor of 2 or possibly 3 more than C, but in a pretty well-defined range. Fortran, for some reason the Fibonacci's go very fast, and some of these are again a little faster than C. This one, which is parsing an integer, is terrible. And then other languages here, like, okay, here's Python. You know, it's all of factors up to a factor of maybe this is 20 slower. Mathematica, R, MATLAB. MATLAB, some is as fast as C. Others are way, way slower. And that's because, you know, it's executing the user code and it's interpreting every step of the user code every time through the loop. And Octave, which is a sort of worse implementation than MATLAB. Okay.
So for the Python timings, I mean, my understanding is that all the numerical stuff like NumPy is actually calling the MODPACK library. So why is
that? So let's see. So the I believe, let's see, Python, and this would be the blue one in particular. And where's Python and blue? So yeah, it's calling LAPACK, but it seems like it's about a factor of 2 slower. I'm not sure why.
Factor,
not that big of a deal. And the same is true, you know, so somewhere here I put a link. There are some notes in this link about which of these languages, Julia, Fortran, Python, MATLAB, are all calling LAPACK for the same LAPACK code for their matrix multiplications, which is something. Explains maybe Mathematica is too, but that has something why this blue dot is always about the same value except for Python. I'm not sure why Python's worse.
What the size of those matrices?
Don't know. I don't know whether it's a small matrix done many times or large matrices.
But that goes back to memory management.
Yeah. I would have to look into that.
Right at one.
Oh, here Python. No, this is a different version of the. This is now Python's moved over here.
Yeah.
Different. Yes, and these are all different now. Random mat bolt is gray. So yeah. I think you were reading that right. Now Python's down there. Okay, so. Yes.
Suppose you do the same test, but in Julia you use this irrational type by mistake, I would say.
Yes.
How high up does that change?
So I would expect if you use the rational type, I don't know. You know, if your rational numbers get really, really big, it could be terrible. And we saw, so I will say we saw a factor of 10 using this Galois field matrices.
Okay,
so next we will go to Kermode-Sivishinsky. Okay, so this is not a parallel computation, but it is a PDE. This is my first, I meant to put this as, let me do a modification here with MATLAB lock. Lock UNH math PhD student. Okay, so this was a math PhD doing a minor in applied math at UNH who we did this work together. So okay, so here I wrote up some notes about Kermode-Sivishinsky equation and how we do time stepping on it. Half of, you know, you probably, most of you have done something like this, have done a little numerical work, and so know how these kinds of things operate. I didn't have to show you the fancy, you know, doing the LaTeX in the notebook. And then, okay, so here's Kermode-Sivishinsky equation, linear, nonlinear terms. We do this Crank-Nicholson, we approximate UT with this difference, and then the linear term like this, you know, we do operator splitting, treat one term explicitly, one term explicitly. We arrive down at this equation. If we expand U with Fourier modes, this turns into a matrix. That's a matrix, and we have to compute these things with collocation operations. And essentially, we end up with this equation. We let this thing be B inverse and that A. So we multiply by B on the right-hand side, and we end up with B equal U n plus 1. The next time step is this matrix times this quantity, where these things are collocation calculations. So I wanted to get this up here because that's a formula you're going to see this in code. A's and B's and delta T's and 3/2. Okay. So here's the MATLAB code for that implements that time stepping algorithm. And it's about 40 lines of code. There's a lot of setting up of, you know, setting up of the, you know, the that matrix A and figuring out what the grid is. Then here's the time stepping loop. Basically, each time step you shift the nonlinear term, you know, you're carrying around two nonlinear terms shifting in time. You compute the next one, you do an inverse FFT, square it, take the real part, then get Fourier coefficients again, and then basically you're taking a derivative, you're computing this thing actually as the derivative of u squared, half the derivative of u squared. That's what I'm doing here. This g is 1/2 the derivative operator on u squared. Okay, and then here's that equation, u equals b. Now, since these in Fourier, I meant to say it's important here, somewhat important, that for if u is Fourier expanded and L is just a differentiation operation, then the matrix version of it is a diagonal matrix. So I don't have to do really do linear algebra. It's just a bunch of multiplying by coefficients. So that shows up in the MATLAB code with this dot times. So B, I'm really using this as a vector, the diagonal vector, same thing with A. And I do this dot times multiplication. DT 3/2 is delta T times 3/2. Basically, this line here is implementing that time stepping algorithm. And I save every once in a while, I'll save it to a matrix for plotting later. What's that? No, I'm not de-aliasing there. Yeah, I mean, this is certainly not an ideal algorithm or even an ideal problem, Kermode-Sivashinsky, but, you know, it's comparison between the languages.
There's nothing wrong with not de-aliasing. You just use a bit more modes.
More modes, yeah. What I'm interested in here is so this is not about, this is about comparing the languages on a PDE and not about doing.
Well, no, my question is memory management.
Memory management. Okay, good. Memory management. Let's talk about that. That's an excellent point. So memory management, this is very bad in memory management because each of these things, this is a vector, that's a vector. In MATLAB, I don't know how smart MATLAB compiler is. Pardon me, it's terrible. Okay, good. So based on that, I would say this takes one vector, multiplies it by a scalar, creates a new vector. Same thing here. That's another new vector. Subtract those two vectors, that produces a third new vector. You know, we can count up, this thing probably creates about 10 temporary vectors each time step, which is, if it's done in the most naive fashion, is going out and, you know, allocating memory, you know, doing a system called allocate memory, fill in a vector, fill in another vector, add them to another system call for memory. So this is actually really terrible memory-wise. This is generating a lot of memory churn. But that's how you would write your code in MATLAB, typically. Okay.
The compiler optimization features, not that.
Well, compilers, ideally, yes. And so let me hold on to that for a second. That's a hard compiler problem. that's not so easy for a compiler to look at this and say, oh, let me unroll the loops and just do this in a for loop. And, you know, a human can certainly look at this and do that. Let me postpone that, actually, because I want to talk about that in a minute, that specific thing. So naive here, I'm going to implement this thing in Julia, and it's basically a line-by-line translation of the MATLAB code down to the same thing here with, and I think this is the very same line. And let's see, good, okay, good. So let's run it. Okay, and plot the results. So there we go. There's a plot of the Kermode-Sivashinsky with time going upwards, just to prove that we actually did the simulation. Now let's compare the execution times. Oh, undefined error. Oh boy. Okay. I did not. I'll have to hold on. I'm gonna have to hit some buttons. Okay, it's taking a while. So this is one of the rough edges of Julia. Sometimes it takes a while to load in a package. That was loading in PyPlot. I made my plot. Now, here's a question. What runs faster? So this is the project that I did with Mahtab, was to implement as close as we could, line by lines of code, the same that this algorithm in Python, in Julia, in MATLAB, and in C++. And the C++ is kind of just, it's like it's C, but I'm using the C++ IO libraries instead. So you can take this as C. It's the core is C code. Okay, and you'll see I have two versions. I have Julia naive and Julia tuned. The naive one was that one that's doing all this extra generation of temporary vectors. I'll show you the tuned one in a minute. So here we go. Okay, I'm gonna make this smaller so that we can see it all. Okay. So here's the timing. So this should be dominated by the Fourier transforms, which are n log n, in nx is the number of x grid points here. So I have, here's an n log n line, and then I have colors for the different languages, and I've ordered them the fastest at the bottom. Okay, so here, and here's how it scales with n. So they do all scale n log n, as you'd expect. It's a little bit surprising the Julia comes out faster than the tuned Julia. I'll show you the tuned Julia in a minute. Well, let's start on top. Python is worst. It's about a factor of, maybe a factor of only about 5 or 8 or something like that over the Julia. Then the naive Julia is just a little bit slower than MATLAB. C++ is faster. Okay, so again, this is an order of 10. So all of these things are within an order of 5 of each other. That's pretty good. They're probably all using FFTW at the bottom. And then Julia, the tuned Julia, turns out to be faster than the C++ code. So let me show you the tuned Julia. So the key thing in the tuned Julia is this memory problem. Going into the code and looking for every place where you're generating a temporary variable, particularly a temporary vector, and substituting it for an in-place operation. Let me increase the size so this is readable. So, for example, one, instead of saying u equals, you know, v equals FFT of u, that would generate a temporary vector and assign it. I'm going to go into here. This, if you've done FFTW, you recognize the FFTW here. This is the Python or the Julia interface to FFTW. I create some in-place FFTs. In Julia, exclamation point or bang means a function that modifies its operands. Okay, so this FFT and that FFT will do an in-place FFT on whatever it calls. And then let's get into the time-stepping loop. So the time-stepping loop is quite a bit different here and is longer. And one thing I've done is I've unwrapped all the computations. I'm not using vector computations because those generate temporaries. I'm unrolling them and, you know, marching over the indices and doing, this is like more like C code here, okay? But the reason to do that is because it can compile nice and fast rather than generating, you know, using the generating temporaries.
You do that in Python, for example, instead of using NumPy.
Yeah.
It really slows things down.
It does really, because in Python or in MATLAB, because in Python, you would be interpreting this all the time. And it's better to make one function call on the vector and go into compile code and do the multiplication on the vector. But then that, again, that is still slower than if you did it in raw C with a for loop. And that's what I'm kind of emulating here. So the thing is with the Julia code, I'm having to do more work. I'm having to say I'm using this inbounds operation, which is telling Julia, don't bother doing index checking on this array access. I know this is okay. So So in this code, I've done everything possible I can to get the Julia code to run as fast as C. Fast math means I don't care what order you do this, you know, I don't care whether you do this multiplication or assignment or using, I don't care how you do it, just do it with floating point, the fastest floating point arrangement. Same thing down here. So, and then in-place FFTs. So I had to unpack that Julia code a little bit, and it took some knowledge of what's happening underneath, but I got it to run as faster than the C++. And it was, you know, it was modifying a little bit of core code rather than rewriting in another language. So.
So, John, just as a Python person myself, I feel like you may not be being that fair to Python. So if you were to do this in Python, you wouldn't do loops. You wouldn't say for I equals 1 to the length.
Yeah.
You just do the matrix, do it as an array. And then that would be just as fast as C.
Okay, it would be just as fast for C, except for the fact that it's generating temporary vectors.
But if you take your loop there, where NNI is NNI times NNI, if you just wrote that as NN equals NN times NN in Python, that would be nearly as fast as C. Sure, if you do a Python loop and do it element by element, that would be slow.
Yeah, no, but I still think there's something missing here. If you go back, If you do this as a vector operation in a language like Python, it's going to, hold on, maybe I'm missing something. Did you say like a star equals here, or?
No, I just mean if you did NN equals NN times NN.
Yeah, okay, so what that's gonna do is, well, maybe Python in that case, Python is smart enough to figure out that I don't need to do this multiplication, create a vector, and then assign it into that one. That's probably the case. But I'm pretty sure that if you do this kind of thing, you're going to be generating a ton of temporaries. Yeah.
I'm just pointing out.
Okay.
You're comparing naive Julia with naive Python. They're actually the same, except for the very large sizes, right?
Okay. Okay.
And you tuned the Julia, but you didn't tune the Python.
Okay.
I'm curious how well it would do if you'd actually tune the Python.
You can help me tune the Python.
Yeah.
Okay, that'd be good. Okay. So let's see. So lastly here, okay, so here's the tune code. I showed you that. Now I'll show you a figure, and maybe this is going to be unfair to Python in the same way. I certainly will be, because I'm using the same timings. But this is now a plot of CPU time versus number of lines of code for these different algorithms. And so, okay, maybe that's, I don't know, maybe this dot should move down. Here we have all these interpreted languages, which are about 50 lines of code, and they run on quite a different orders of execution time. And then here is C++, which is running just a little bit slower than Julia, but it has more than three times the amount of, you know, typing. And I can show you the C++ code. It's, you know, I'm a longtime C++ programmer, but there are lots of ways I will not defend C++ as a language. Let's see. So, is that okay? You don't really need to see the details here, but let's get down here. Oh my God, okay, so, you know, here are the constructing the FFTW plans. I have to construct a new one for everything. Here are, okay, and I have all my unwrapped loops, and I have to do all this memory management. Actually, its main thing is the memory management in the C++, is adding all the pain to it. And the syntax is more complicated. It took me, even though I've been programming in C++ for 20 years, it took me longer, it was and harder to write the C++ than it did the MATLAB or the Python. The Julian, I'm not so good at. Or Python, I'm not so good at. Okay, so that's all. That's basically all I wanted to do. Let me put up my conclusions, which are to say that Julia is a well-designed open-source scientific programming language with great types, both numeric and general purpose. I didn't show you the general purpose libraries. I've probably showed you, I know I showed you some pretty amazing things that it can do, and that it's nearly as fast as C. It's got this easy learning curve because it starts out, which you might think it's MATLAB. And then the metaprogramming is really amazing. I haven't really touched on that so much. So, you know, because you can do code transformations on the language itself, that opens it up for things like automatic differentiation. You can give Julia a function, and then you can, as an expression, and then you can define an operation. What kind of operations do I need to do on that expression in order to turn it into the derivative of the same expression? You can do that in Julia code. Okay, and then compile it and have it run as fast as C. Okay. And then, HPC, I haven't shown you anything about parallelism that people are doing, parallelism, and, okay. So what I didn't cover, but I put links to are how to do parallel computing, all the general purpose libraries, installation, here are the underlying libraries, the modules and package manager, the coding. Julia Box is a cloud computing service where you can sort of log in and do Julia computing and keep all your files there, so you can do it without that. And then lastly, acknowledgements. These two guys are on the Julia team, and Dave has been really helpful, and Andreas, I've stolen a bunch of his stuff from the notebook, and thanks to the Julia team. Okay, that's all I have to say. And if there are any further, I don't know if there are further questions, I got a lot of them as we went along. We'll see.
I still have a question. I mean, it seems that you want to invert a large page.
Mm-hmm.
How would you do it? Would you be able to go there and write a do loop?
Oh, well, you know, probably you would just use the standard libraries, which if you're using 64 bits would, you know, call LAPACK.
I mean large.
Large, really large. So then you would use distributed, the distributed arrays and distributed matrices. And I don't really know what's going on there in Julia development. So
I mean, basically then you would go down to C and write in C.
Let's see.
Speaking of the test, it was a supercomputer, so very large dense matrix, or?
Sorry, I'm only running. Yes,
pretty
testing.
So a very large dense matrix you are speaking about?
Very
large,
yeah.
Dense,
or, yeah. Well, very large matrix. I mean, just in that case, you also get catch. I mean, the question is always is, what happens when you get out of the catch?
Okay, so Julia does have distributed arrays, and I believe distributed linear algebra on those. Isn't ScalyPack is the library for MPI-ified LAPACK. So you put an array over distributed processor. I don't know what would happen. I don't know how to do it. So, Julia.
There's a book called Julia High Performance Programming. There's activities going on.
He sent it off.
I'm sorry. What you said?
There's a book called the Julia High Performance Computing. High performance programming?
Well, high performance programming, that's not the same as high performance computing.
Okay. So I'd have to answer. I don't know what the state of the art is of parallel linear algebra.
Is it even used for any large program?
For a large program, so let's see. So I don't think there are any fluids codes out there. So large programs. So large programs. I think people, data analytics. That's one of the the Wall Street funding is for people doing big data analysis, and that I think that is driving much of the distributed computing in Julia. I can't say that. That there's a large, PDE simulation in Julia. I don't know of one yet, but the language is in its infancy, and so that's for me. Maybe my next step, I want to do something like implement a parallel isotropic cube turbulence and see how it goes.
Okay. I mean, usually it's big data people. They don't really use big data sets. They do something at all. They do something which is small. They do it a million times.
I don't know what to say. I have seen demos of Julia distributed computations in which a guy at a laptop has, is hooked into a cluster, and he allocates a matrix over 100 nodes on a cluster and fills them with random numbers, and then types a function to evaluate over those things and sends it down the wire, and it does a collect and comes back with an answer. So at that level, I know it's happening, but I don't know of any big working high-performance code at this point.
I mean, it's different. You have something which is a small program that will fit in your laptop, and then you want to run it in a million laptops.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, they're definitely, I can say confidently that the development team is not limited to laptops and single processors. The big cluster is the... You'd have to go in there. You have to plan it from the beginning as a parallel computation. And,
Or something like solving a Poisson. Constantly you have to be changing data from one place to another. Because are two different programs. I don't know how.
But if you use a standard MPI, it should have also MPI on two or called for small.
You have to do it.
What's that?
You have to do it. You have to rearrange your memory every time you transpose. The poles are complicated. It doesn't that you do it. Basically, at the center, there's not the.
Yeah. It's a horrific pain.
Sure.
I mean, I'll say it's a horrific pain, but the FFTW implementations of parallelized transforms are in there. MPI is available in there, so you can do it if you're willing to code in that. And then the Julia team is working on a higher level interface, which is less assembly language like for doing parallel communications. Yes?
In this example of the question that you had expanded the loops in the optimizer, but isn't it possible just to use some vector operation without expanding the inner loop?
you can do the you can do the vector operations, but they generate temporary vectors.
There's no way to avoid that.
Well, there is okay. So the Intel Julia team has written macros which take like the most compact for loop and unroll it to generate that code. So there is code to do that, but it's not part of the standard language yet. It's an add-on package. At this point, if you want the speed of C, unrolling is the way to go. Okay. Call it. Thanks for extending it.